Okay then, we'll move on your count.
I'm hit!
You gonna be alright?
Yeah, thanks, Thane. I've got it from here.
Take care of yourself, then. And you better stay out of Reed Quad, because I'm not gonna be around again to pull you out when it all goes to hell.
Thanks for saving my butt.
Safe travels.
Yeah, safe travels to you too. Maybe we'll see each other again sometime.
Approaching the planet Reed Quad. Coordinates set for Lasser Dudanham.
Ship. Identity. Wayfarer, you are cleared to dock. Please proceed to the landing bay.
Alright, okay. Keep this thing steady. Why does the orbital station have to rotate so fast? Okay. Think I've got this. Oh, fates! There goes a starboard thruster. I've lost the landing skid. Oops. There goes the other one. Okay, I'm looking good. Almost there. Touchdown! I don't know how I'm alive still, but I'm not going to bag it. I have to go see shipyards, see what they can do about my ship. On the way, I'll talk about my novel, discuss my newsletter, some of the stuff in the DDF, that's the Design Decision Forum, and a little bit of other stuff, and I'll finish with some feedback and how the podcasts are going. Okay. Shipmaster's office. Fuel? Honest Tom's Emporium? Main concourse? Shipmaster. Here we go. Okay, so it's the middle of June. It's been a long 6 months, but also a short 6 months. So I've designed the novel, I've written the draft, I've reread the whole novel, I've looked at all the areas that I think are particularly weak, and now I'm going through and fixing up all those areas, and up to page 30 of what's now a 230-page manuscript. So I'm adding a lot of content there. I've already gone up about 4,000 words on the draft. Of course, this will probably go down again after subsequent edits, but right now I'm not tightening, I'm building muscle. And the way to build muscle is to throw protein at your body, but also throw carbs. You do a lot of bodybuilding, you get your muscles sore and they need fuel. And so if you just throw protein at your body, the protein goes into making the muscles refueled instead of rebuilding. So you throw the carbs and protein at your muscles, so the muscles suck up the carbs to refuel, and then they use the protein to build. And as a consequence of that, sometimes there can be a bit of flab creep in. That's okay, I'll worry about that in a later editing pass. I'm a big fan of David Farland, or David Wolverton, and he has a daily kick that he does, just sort of full of advice and ideas for writers. And he talks about his editing process. You know, he does multiple passes, each one concentrating on a particular aspect. You know, the first pass might just be, well, he likes to add in value to start off with before he trims and polishes it, the same as myself. So he might go on and sort of look at his dialogue and make sure it's realistic but not too slangy. Then he might go through and look at his language, making sure his metaphors are crisp, that they're appropriate. Then he might have a pass where he goes through and make sure each chapter finishes on a good hook, and then starts on a good hook. So you go from one chapter to the next without putting the book down. And so he concentrates on one thing, and he goes through, then he goes through again, and goes through again. And I remember reading that, you know, on some stories he's done up to 12 passes on a novel just to cover everything off and make sure he's got it sorted. So, you know, I'm aiming for 4 passes, not 12. Everyone's different. We'll see how we go. If I've got the time, of course, I'll throw another pass at it. I basically want to make it as perfect as possible before the launch date. So on this first editing pass, I've just added a scene into the novel about 20 pages in. It's a pretty cool space battle. What the context is we've had the initial scene where we've ended up fleeing from the bad guys. And then I went away and dealt with some other point of views. And then I come back basically in the middle of a battle. And on second reading, you know, some assumptions have been made by the characters, perhaps without enough sort of logic or proof in there for the reader. So, you know, some readers might sort of accept that, but maybe some readers would think, well, how did he come to that conclusion? You know, worst case, just fully not believe it. So I've added this scene in. It's segments of a real cool space battle with some really cool scenes in it. I really quite love it. But I felt I needed to put it in just to connect from A to C. So I put that B step in there. I don't want to, you know, without sort of putting spoilers in there, but it makes it a more logical progression of his fleeing from the opposition, that all the steps now make more sense. You've got a bit more information there, and it just feels like a bit more sense. But you have to be careful when you're adding a new scene into a story. You can't just chuck it in because it'll be a good idea or it'll be a cool space battle. It's not what it's about. You've actually got to make sure it carries its weight. And to carry its weight, it can't just do one thing, make this logical progression work. It has to do a few more things as well. And there's a lot of things that a scene can do. And what this scene's doing is adding characterization. I've podcasted about this and I've talked about it before. I follow the 4-act sort of structure for my novel. And the first act is the first 20%. There's two things. You're trying to get to know the protagonist and his story and come to either love him or hate him, but, you know, feel empathy for him either way, whether he's a hero or an anti-hero. As well as see glimpses of the approaching storm. And I've got the approaching storm part down pat. I just feel that, you know, another thing for this scene is that it's adding more value to the character. You're seeing more of his thought process, who he cares about, what drives him, and that should be bringing a bit more empathy into the story. So by the time I hit that first plot point that happens at 20%, that's the point where the whole story sort of turned on its head and the hero's now got a proper goal to work towards. You know, you want to, by the time you get to this point in the story, you really want to know the character and you want to sort of feel like you want to support him and keep reading about him. So this scene should just add a little bit there just to make that hopefully just feel a bit more natural, a bit more organic. But of course I have to, you know, question myself on this. You know, is it just window dressing? And I don't think it is. But it is a relatively long scene. So, you know, it might get trimmed down on later edits. Right now though, it's quite a fun read, at least I think it is. Alpha readers will either agree with me or not, and their advice will be invaluable in the whole novel, of course, but for the scene to find if it's too long, too short, whether it should be there or not. So we'll see how that goes. So I just released my third newsletter a couple of days ago. Released that in both PDF format, in glorious colour, and some pictures. It's got a graph and a photo of some of the calculations that I've done. I haven't been able to figure out how to put pictures into Kindle yet, so if anyone does know, let me know. I find it bloody hard work, to be honest, to get the Kindle format working just with words. If anyone with experience out there knows how to put, you know, images into the e-books, please get in contact with me. Tell me what to do. It'd be appreciated. Anyway, the engineering section of the newsletter seems to be the clear favourite so far. I think maybe those of you that aren't, it's good to be able to see, understand perhaps some of the science that's going into the science fiction. You know, I try to explain it in a pretty clear fashion and get rid of the jargon and sort of perhaps make you think about some things that you haven't thought about before. I bet those of you who played Elite haven't really ever thought about the cooling of the starship and what mechanics go in inside the ship and outside the ship to make that work. So, you know, I deal with a lot of heat transfer in my job, so it's of interest to me, and hopefully it might be interesting to you. Hopefully I'll keep coming up with some good engineering topics relative to, or in relation to, Elite Dangerous as we roll throughout the year. On that note, can anyone believe it's June already? It feels like yesterday that I was standing at the kitchen with my wife with a laptop on the range, watching the minutes count down to the end of the Indiegogo campaign and watching the money roll in and get across that line. And here I am half a year later with an Elite Dangerous Novel draft and still a whole lot of work left to do. So in the newsletter, I talked about the heating and cooling of a ship in Elite Dangerous and how that might actually work in reality, and a bit of an analysis on that. Basically, you've got a heat plant of some description in your ship, and it creates energy. So the first thing it does, obviously, is make the ship go forward. The second thing it does is provide power to all the systems inside your ship, not least being the big gun that pokes out the front. So all those things use energy, and when you have a heat plant which creates energy, there is waste heat produced. In your standard heat engine, you have energy goes in, work comes out, and the resultant goes to waste heat. And so you have about, you know, it differs between, you know, types of equipment, but, you know, nominally sort of 10% of that's going to go to waste heat that you have to get rid of. In the future, of course, could be less, but you have to, you know, find a way to get rid of that heat. And so in the newsletter, I discussed a few options for dealing with that. So if you've received the newsletter, have a read of that. I think it's pretty interesting. If you don't get the newsletter and that kind of thing's of interest, you have a look at the website and you can sign up for it. So the Design Decision Forum, I'm not actually a member of that. I'm not sure if anyone actually realised that, but you know, you get that as the writer's, part of the writer's pack pledge on the Kickstarter. But to get myself across the line, I basically sold all the fancy things that come with it. I sold my planet, I sold the solar system I get to name, the space station I get to name, and I sold my alpha testing, and I sold my DDF membership. So I don't get to see all the news as it happens. I get to see it, yeah, when it occurs in the archives, just like the rest of you. So I'm a bit behind what they talk about in the live radio. But, you know, I'm still interested in it and might like to hear what I've got to say about it. In terms of the multiple ships and the hangars and the trading in ships, well, that's pretty much been discussed to death in various mediums. I've got nothing really to add there. I mean, I can't see anything there sparking an uprising. It all sounds pretty fine. You know, just expansion on first encounters, you know, I'm quite pretty happy with it. Inter-system transport. Yeah, my personal feeling, you know, didn't really like the direction we'd gone in, just from a personal feeling. It's not really what I wanted from Elite, but in terms of a massive multiplayer or MMO sort of game, it's necessary. I mean, space is big, so massive. So you need to force encounters between players together. It has to sort of be, you can't just let them do their own thing. Even just in one solar system, the chance of finding people is pretty slim, unless they all hang around Earth or hang around Mars. So, you know, you need this system to force encounters together. And it's a pretty good way of doing it, I think. But it's very Wing Commander-ish. I'm thinking Wing Commander 3, where you'd go on a mission, you had sort of four waypoints you had to fly around, and at each waypoint there was a vast space you could explore. There could be asteroids, it could be stations, but mostly there was a bunch of cool wrath that you had to kill. So explorable areas around waypoints, and the waypoints are connected via some system which makes time pass fast for the player. Player groups, there's quite a bit to digest there. If you haven't already read about it in the archive, I suggest you go do that. There's a lot going on there, and I'm not really a big MMO guy. I dabbled in World of Warcraft for a few years at university, but, you know, I'm not really into the whole scene, and all these terms sort of going over my head a bit. But what I did like is that you could have both a grouping and a friends list. Gotta say, I don't really fully understand the advantages and disadvantages and when they're going to come into play. But I know that most players of the game are going to be in Europe, and then perhaps secondly, you know, Russia or America. Argue Russia's part of Europe, I suppose. But the point being, not many of them are going to be where I am, down the Antipodes. There's a few guys in Australia, one or two of us in New Zealand, as far as I understand. If anyone listening's from New Zealand and you're an Elite Dangerous player, please get in contact with me. I really want to have a chat to you. I want to see what we can do to sort of promote Elite Dangerous in New Zealand. But anyway, most of the players are in Europe. I talk to a lot of the Elite community members, but you're all on the wrong side of the planet. So the times that I'm free to play the game, you know, most of them are going to be at work. And not really, well, hopefully not wanting to play the game. So I'd like them to be on my friends list. So if I catch on the weekends, we can, catch up, whatever. But probably not practical for groups. So if I do end up in a group, it's probably going to be a local group, I imagine. So I like that. Something I don't quite understand, something I'm not sure of, and, you know, wouldn't mind some clarification from listeners. Slaving of hyperdrives is something of interest to me. I got the sense that you can only do that in alliances. So, say I've got an alliance, but I've also got, you know, a wingman on the side, shall we say, and perhaps I want to do some sly hyperdrive slave with my dude on the side there, you know, separate from my alliance. I don't know if that situation could ever exist, but is there any way I could do hyperdrive slaving with my best mate over there while I've still got my alliance on the side? I don't know, maybe you just have to forced to tailgate each other, but, you know, there's an inherent risk in that as I understand it, so I'm not sure if that's ideal. Anyone have any ideas? Get in touch with them, let me know. john@andhearthewheel.co.nz, or just hit me up on the site or the forums, anywhere really. Let me know what you think. TJ's got his own blog. He's writing about his book, Out of the Darkness, and he put quite an interesting article on his website just the other day, basically talking about the problems that arise when you're writing your novel in someone else's sandpit, and when that sandpit isn't actually complete. That sandpit might be, you know, being built and rebuilt at the same time, and the frustrations and difficulties that makes for writers such as ourselves. So I really enjoyed that one, so I suggest you check it out if you can. outofthedarkness.info/blog/. Check it out. I understand the issues that he's having, totally agree. My response wasn't quite the same as his. Went on a slightly different road. So what I did when I was planning the novel back in January is, you know, I had clear plans for what systems things were going to occur in. So I'd worked out where, you know, my protagonist came from, a few other planets he visits, a few places he ends up at. And I definitely had a clear plan of progression of travel from the beginning of the novel to the end of the novel, where those systems were in relation to everything else. And actually went to Frontier and said, this is where I wanted to do things, blah, blah. And they said, of course, that, well, the maps completely changed from first encounter, so of course that sort of stops me from being able to name the systems. But their locations, their characteristics, their populations, their relationships to the Federation, the Empire, Independence, those are all still going to be intact. And so I can't name the systems too well, but the actual character of the places I'm going to isn't changing. It's not like I'm just sort of upping the novel from this place and putting it down this place. It's the same place, it's the same design, it's just the actual name is going to change and any other sort of features that Frontier Developments puts in, but it's not going to actually change the soul of what's going on. Other things I've sort of written in a way where I can cut out some details and put it back in with different details to suit Frontier's vision. For example, in my last blog post, talked about it. I wrote a scene that everyone's running around the bridge during combat, and of course that can't happen. So that was actually pretty easy to repair. And there's going to be other things more than likely occur during the novel that I'm going to have to change, and I've sort of made it easy for myself to fix these. Ships are another good example. In terms of the ship usage, I've been precise where I need to be, but intensely vague where I can get away with it. You could argue I don't need to be any more detailed because you're going to play the game, you're going to know these ships, you're going to fill in the gaps yourself, so I don't need to be too specific. But I want to be specific enough so you know that, yes, I am flying an Anna or an Anaconda. Where I've been vague, it doesn't affect the story, so I think I've come up with a good system where I can back myself regardless of what happens. For example, there's a Lana in the story, and I have a mechanic basically cringing at it when it's mentioned. For those of you that have played First Encounters and know what a Lana is, they're basically infamous for their poor design and general crappiness. These sort of flavours that sort of came in from the early games, I want still to be able to use those. There's going to be different designs, there's going to be different relationships between mechanics and ship designs, so I'm not going to worry about it. I'm going to write myself a cracking story and worry about the props later. Yeah, give myself a few backup plans just in case. So I brought some new headphones the other day on oneday.co.nz. It's a website New Zealand. There's probably similar things across the globe. They have end-of-line products from suppliers and sell them cheap to get rid of them. The brand is Muse, and they're like day glow orange, not really the best colour, but doesn't matter, they were cheap. So I'm using them for the editing and the mastering of the podcast, and they produce great sound. At least it feels like really great sound, but my standards are pretty low because I've been using your basic eye headphones. Bass is pretty good. You know, I'm 30 years old, and my days of bass brain smashing are long gone, but I still appreciate a bit of boom to my music, which is probably slightly immature, but we're all old men talking about computer games, so par the course. Something that's come up on the forums around the Conclave is audio scripting. That's really interesting. I like the things that have come up, sort of Darren Gray and Foz have had their own sort of text on it, and got to say, I've tried a few things through the podcast. Initially, I just sort of played it by ear, and that was really hard to edit. So then I gave myself a full-on script, and that sort of made editing pretty easy. But I guess I'm not a very good actor. I read it, and I feel like I was reading too fast. And, I mean, it wasn't unnatural, but it was, I don't know, it feels to me like I was a bit too fast, and I've sort of heard that from a few other guys as well. While whenever I've sort of done things half off the cuff, is then I've sort of given myself a cheat sheet, if you will, dot bullet points. It's sort of given my brain something to focus on, but then I've still had to sort of figure out exactly what I'm saying, and that sort of slowed me down a notch. Yeah, slowed me down a notch so I don't sound like I'm talking too fast. And at least that's the plan, so I don't know if anyone can hear a difference between this podcast, episode 7, and podcast 6, episode 6, which was basically completely scripted, versus now, where I've got a page of bullet points that I'm looking at right now, and I'm fumbling and umming and ahhing, and I'm taking all those out so you don't hear them. But, you know, how does it sound? Does it sound better? Worse? You indifferent? You don't really care? Or my bassy voice is so sexy anyway, you don't really care? Anyway, let me know. Practice comes into it. So I'm still sort of, I guess, finding my feet on a system that works well for me. The more I do it, the better I get, hopefully. On my last update on my website, I gave you guys quite a bit of detail on some editing that I'd done on my story. Did a bit of an extract and gave you the before and after and got a lot of feedback from you guys, so thanks a lot for that. I really appreciate that. But interesting comments came out of it, ripping into the cliches that I put in there. Of course, everyone hates cliches, and they snuck in because it was, I'd written new words, so it was kind of, it was an edit, but it was draft quality words in my edit. But it was, you know, it was arguments to and fro. But what really sort of, I guess, the crux of the conversation was, is it okay to say cliches or just sayings, phrases that are accepted today in the year 3300? And it's really interesting, and we've talked about it a lot in the private writers forum. I don't think there's any right answer. The right answer, I suppose, is what throws the least number of readers out of the story. You're not going to please everyone, but you want to do, obviously, the best you can. And I tend to want to go to the historical sort of side of the spectrum. I've read stories, and I guess maybe some of them are fan fiction, where everything's sort of, you know, futuristic and mechanical, and everything, all the metaphors and phrases relate to ships, for example. And I don't know about you guys, but that just really pisses me off, to be honest. I mean, sure, the person might be a pilot, but take a pilot now, they don't, you know, or maybe a pilot's not the right answer for modern day, but someone who lives on their yacht, perhaps, you know, they don't live, you know, every single day on that yacht. They go on shore to get supplies, talk to people, you know, go check out the local flora and fauna and the people, and they would have lived some part of their life on land. They're not going to be a entity that's just lived its entire life on a yacht and knows nothing except the borders of the water and the hull of their ship. You know, you're going to have phrases involving stuff on the ground. Animals, perhaps. You can lead a horse to water, but you can't make a drink. That's a phrase that dates from 1,000 years ago, and you could argue it's still going to be there in 1,000. Then you could argue that, you know, are people really going to talk about horses? How common are horses? And I suppose if you're born in the middle of a corporate world that's just high-rises and industry, perhaps you won't. But a guy that was born on a frontier world, they're definitely going to be horses or some kind of mammal. Animals are going to be part of your life. So it's sort of appropriate for them to sort of have phrases that involve horses, or, you know, whatever they grow up with is going to be sort of particular things about their planet. And they're going to have phrases that arise from that. And a bit, of course, if you spend any time in space, you're going to start picking up the space parlance as well. So I think a well-rounded person, such as my protagonist, he's going to have sayings that sort of, and ideas and words that come from his culture where he grew up. But he's been in space now for a while, so he's going to be have some of that parlance as well. So it's probably going to be a combination, I think, is the most appropriate way to go. And that's sort of where I'm going. Hopefully that's the right answer, and again, my alpha readers will be invaluable in telling me that. If everyone just writes back and says, John, you're just throwing me out of the story every time you use a phrase from the modern day, well, then I'll just have to, if that's what everyone says, I'll just have to take that on board. But, you know, I believe in my system, and we'll see what happens. Okay, so feedback I've had. So Red Ravens commented on the blog about the podcast. He reckons it's about right in terms of, I was questioning the audio drama or metafiction-y bits, how they relate to just the pure content. He reckons the mix is about right, which is what I was sort of feeling, obviously, which is why I produced it the way I did. So it's good to get that positive feedback. Thanks, Red. Appreciate that. Glad to hear how everyone else feels about it. You know, I've been doing a lot of research on podcasts lately, just trying to sort of optimize it for you guys, for all the listeners. And I think I've got it pretty nailed, but, you know, I'd love to hear feedback. You know, if there's something I should improve, reorder things, more of this, less of that, please let me know. john@andheatherwheel.co.nz. Please let me know. Also been talking to Chris Jarvis about my mastering and editing of the audio. As most of you probably know, he's the brains behind Escape Velocity. He's got a lot of experience there, so I've used some of that. He's given me some ideas for the mastering. So again, thanks Chris for that. Take that all on board. And got my 7th review on iTunes, thanks to Celazin. Thought it was quite unique in the way I'd put it together, so thanks for that. Off Elite Dangerous News, not sure if anyone's interested in that, but here we go anyway. I'm at work, I'm just rushing full bang into a big project. It's going to involve dismantling, rebuilding and testing a huge furnace that has 32 burners in it. 32 liquid petroleum gas burners. Of course, LPGs we call it in New Zealand. That's basically just a mix of propane and butane. I don't think you do that anywhere except New Zealand and Australia. So it's about a 60-40 mix of the two. Pretty potent stuff. So I've got 32 of those, and each one's knocking out a flame about 1 meter long. So there's going to be quite a few kilowatties in that furnace. And it's got a removable side, so they can put test specimens against it. So it might sound impressive, but really, when each one of these 32 burners needs individual controls, setting up individually, tuning, tweaking, optimizing individually, it does get pretty repetitive. But it is winter, and it is getting cold, so standing in front of that puppy at full noise will definitely keep the icicles off my nose. Alright, well I think I've found the shipmaster's office here. Better talk about that junk of a cobra that's sitting on the landing platform, getting that repaired and yeah, see how long that'll take. Probably going to be here for a while. This is my first time, of course, to Le Sieur du Danham, and so far on this walk I haven't been stabbed, shot or mugged. You would think I should probably quit while I'm ahead, but I heard about a guy who hides out in the station, so once I talk to the shipmaster here I'll do some homework and see if I can catch up with him before I leave the station. I also saw an advert for Honest Tom's Emporium. Might be something for sale there I can use to pass the time. So thanks everyone for listening. Hope you enjoyed it. Love your feedback as always. Catch you next time. And here is some Two Quiet Sons to see us out.